Hi, and welcome to Bloody Good Reads. I'm your host, Mark Goddard, and welcome back to yet another amazing author on the podcast. But this week we've got an author whose brand new book is actually very, very interesting, one that I've got in my next to read list. Welcome to the podcast, Alison Littlewood.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me along.
No worries. Welcome to the podcast. So here on Bloody Good Reads, we make authors pick free books because we're mean like that. And we're also here to talk to you about your new book and some of the books that you wrote when you kind of first started writing. So I'll start my podcast like I always do. And how did you get into the genre?
How did I get into it? Well, for a lot of years, I kind of thought about writing and kind of had a secret dream that I'd love to have a book with my name on the cover, but never really dared to try. So I think I got to about 2003 and forced myself just to join a local creative writing course. And I can remember going along on the first night and they said, okay, right now we're going to do a 10-minute writing exercise on this subject. And I was like, oh my God, do I have to actually write? And it just forced me to start putting the pen to the page and coming up with ideas. And I started off actually tinkering around with poetry and then went on to writing short stories and got more and more drawn into dark fiction and started writing for the indie presses and getting things published. So it went on from there, really.
When did you get into the horror genre? Because a lot of your books are horror-based. So was you always a fan when you were growing up to horror genre? Or
I read horror when I was growing up. I certainly read Stephen King, but I wasn't exclusively into the genre. I mean, I pretty much read anything and everything that came within my grasp, really. I just love books. But it was once I started writing that I very quickly found that, you know, even back on the writing course before I was even doing short stories, they'd go around the room and they'd be kind of, ooh, and ah, oh, that's nice. And mine, it'd be, ooh, that's the kind of reaction I got. And I think I just started to be drawn to darker ideas. They're the ones that made me want to get to the keyboard. But I think the signs were probably there when I was really little, because I just loved Hans Christian Andersen's fairy tales. And some of those, I kind of think of them now as horror for kids, you know. They're quite dark, some of them.
Oh, definitely. Really, really dark story. Think about most of them. If you think a lot of his stories are kind of Disney movies now, but if you really read his actual works, especially like the Grimm's fairy tales and that kind of things as well, so much darker back in the day.
Yeah, definitely. What's that Grimm's one called? The children who played at slaughtering or something like that. I mean, there's no holds barred. Yeah.
So let's start from the beginning. Again, you were saying you did a lot of short stories. I see that you had a couple of books with PS Publishing. A lot of people seem to start with PS Publishing over here. How did you get involved with that? Was it a cold season or...?
It was actually published first by Joe Fletcher Books, and PS Publishing came along afterwards and did a special edition of it. So it's kind of an illustrated hardcover. But that was the novel that started me off, really. It must have been about 2010, something like that. And I was in a full-time job at the time and got made redundant on, I think it was a Monday in June. And on the Friday, I got a call from Jo Fletcher saying that she wanted to publish it. And after a conversation on the phone, it turned into a 3-book deal. So I suddenly knew what I was going to be doing for the next few years. So yeah, Cold Season was my first novel.
It must be quite nice though, because it's a Richard and Judy book club pick as well.
Yeah, I was just going to say, probably even more bizarrely. Yeah, it got picked up for the Richard and Judy. So suddenly it wasn't just a case of, you know, we're trying to fight to get this new author a place on a shelf. It was suddenly in every single window at WH Smith's and on stands out at the front of the shop, and there were posters and advertising and all the national dailies and all this stuff going on. And it was completely surreal, especially for a new author, I think.
Obviously, back when, you know, they were still on TV, I mean, Rich and Judy were kind of the pinnacle of, like, you know, you get your, it's like the Oprah Book Club in a way. It's, you know, that's a huge, huge honour.
Yeah,
and,
definitely.
You know, definitely a way to kind of push you on there.
Yeah, and they weren't on TV at the time, but they still did video interviews. So I had to go down to London and have my moment on the couch with Richard and Judy. So, yeah, it's completely surreal. And, you know, they were really kind and really really, really lovely and very into all the books. So, yeah, it was good.
So, where did you go from that series? Because you've had, obviously, the Cold Season trilogy.
Well, A Cold Season was two books, actually. I wrote a sequel for it, but although that was about three books afterwards. So I only wrote it really when I'd got an idea that would stretch to it. At first, I wrote something else. I came up with Path of Needles, which went back to that love of fairy tales, really. And I started off by thinking, you know, some of the things that happen in fairy tales are pretty gruesome. And if they happened in an everyday life kind of setting, you know, how would that go? Because kids kind of read them and these things are just safe between the covers and the book. And they don't seem particularly affected by it. But, you know, if things actually happened in everyday life, as they do in fairy tales, things would get pretty dark, pretty fast. So I ended up writing kind of a police procedural meets dark fantasy. So that was Path of Needles, and that was my second book.
Saying that was one of the ones that really caught my eye, the whole kind of fairy tale and murders and that kind of thing. It's very, it draws you in. That's just the plot of that book. So it's, yeah, I like that kind of one. You see very little kind of dark fairy tale stuff. So it's nice when you kind of mix it in a little bit of the crime as well.
I guess I mixed it in with everyday settings as well. I actually set it around where I lived. So basically to call the local beauty spots and turn them into body dump sites, which was quite good fun. So I'd be going on research trips around them thinking, okay, how would you get a body from that car park up to the moat of the castle?
The morbid things you think about when you're writing. off subject. Because I dabble writing on occasion, but I was sitting there today and I work in a tool shop. And, you know, I've got the story idea in my head and I'm thinking, what tools can you use to remove somebody's teeth with a bit? I'm not going to ask my boss that. I might be fine. But the weird things you think about when you're writing, you think,
yeah, people knew what was in your head.
Really obvious. Let's segue into it then. So, again, as we do on the podcast every time, we get you to pick three books that you absolutely love. So, what is your first bloody good read?
Right, my first pick. This is one that, for me as a writer, it taps into some of the things that I really, really love. And I adore this book. It's Starvake by Andrew Michael Hurley. So the guy who wrote The Loney. It's his most recent book, I think, and possibly the shortest. It seems like quite a short, neat read. It's kind of no longer than it needs to be, and it's just a little jewel of a book. And it's folk horror, so... I mean, I love folklore anyway. I love that sense that, you know, when you go somewhere, there's all these layers of stories under your feet waiting to be excavated. And I think, you know, even referring to that kind of thing can just add resonance and depth to any story you want to kind of spin on top of it. And it's set in a dismal little corner of Yorkshire as well, which is something else I quite like. I'm quite fond of that myself. But essentially, there's a couple who are mourning the loss of their five-year-old boy. And the man, Richard, starts to excavate the roots of an old gallows tree, which is buried on his land. Meanwhile, his wife is convinced that the spirit of the child is still hovering around. And backstory starts to tell us that this child was very troubled. And, you know, creepy kids are something else that I really love in fiction, and this child was becoming distinctly creepy. So you wonder what kind of influence he'd fallen under. And there are just moments of real horror in this book that arise very casually, and they're almost understated. You know, the author's very skillful. It doesn't wallop you over the head with happenings. He almost slips them in, and they're just so much more effective for that. I just think it's a wonderful book.
The creepy kids are a staple in horror. You can't go wrong with a story about creepy kids.
Yeah, definitely. Love a good creepy kid.
Awesome pick. So your third book was The Unquiet House.
Yes, that's right. I wanted to write a ghost story. And yeah, so we were house hunting at the time and looking at lots of old buildings, and parts of them just seem to start finding their way into this story and shaping the plot. And weirdly, after it came out and we actually found a house, it's not completely dissimilar to the one in the Unquiet House. Certainly not haunted, but it's quite an old building that bits of it are 300 years old and very much a place where doors can open and close on their own, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Definitely not haunted. Definitely.
Definitely.
Are you saying it's more Yorkshire way? Yeah, is it? Or
it is, yeah.
Because Yorkshire's got quite a good history of kind of ghosts, and especially York.
Oh, yeah. There's some amazing haunted buildings in York. Well, so the stories go, don't they?
Oh,
but
yeah.
I've done the ghost tour once or twice.
So, from the Unquiet House, where did you go from after that?
Well, I wrote the sequel to A Cold Season, which I mentioned earlier. But after that one, I went historical and got really interested in the Victorian era. That was when I wrote The Hidden People, followed by The Crow Garden, both of which are very much immersed in Victorian tales. So The Hidden People's kind of a fairy tale. It's about somebody who, his cousin is burned on suspicion of being a changeling. Her husband essentially murders her. So he goes to investigate. This kind of slightly naive city boy goes off into the rural backwaters of Yorkshire to uncover exactly what's going on in this little village and whether people genuinely believe that the fairies took this woman or if there's something else going on. But his wife follows him and she starts to act really strangely. So there's a sense of, is there a supernatural cause here or is it more prosaic than that? And the Crow Garden probably got more Victorian still, because that's a bit of a journey into mesmerism and seance rooms. So very much into some of those supernatural obsessions of the era.
I mean, your writing has a lot of kind of the fairy tale aspect of it, because isn't it Cottonley is about fairies as well? Because obviously that's the photographs of the fairies, that's obviously a news article from way back. Is that something that's kind of inspired it, or...?
It did. It's very much wrapped around that whole story of the Cottonley fairies while kind of spinning its own tale. It's mostly set in the present day, actually. It's a story of a young woman called Rose who, she's living quite a dull life working in a care home, but she meets one of the residents called Charlotte Favell, who has a stack of old letters that claim to be about the Cottonley fairies. And they're written by somebody who lived in the same village. But he claims that he's come into possession of a little fairy skeleton. So essentially he's holding the proof that these fairies existed, but they just weren't as they were represented by the photographs. So Rose becomes more and more fascinated, and Charlotte just keeps feeding these letters to her one at a time and drawing her into a bit of a web. And it draws different strands of folklore together. Because the Cottonley fairies that were pictured by Elsie Wright and Francis Griffiths were very much, you know, pretty winged fairies flitting gladsome among the flowers, that kind of idyllic view of them. And that view was kind of popularised in the Victorian era just before they came along. But older stories of fairies, obviously, were more often warnings. And they told about these tricksy creatures that might punish people for spying on them or even steal people away and leave changelings in the place. And meanwhile, Rose discovers that she's pregnant and starts to harbour all kinds of fears about her own baby. And the letters and her life start to intertwine and affect each other.
It fits in with a lot of what you've written before with fairy tales and all that. It's nice to kind of see a through kind of theme to a lot of your writing, which is cool.
It does, and I think I always seem to drawn to ideas about people who aren't what they seem, and you know the changeling idea is kind of the ultimate of that, because the thought that there could be somebody living in your house who looks like the person you love and talks like them but isn't them, I think that's really properly creepy. So yeah, there are real gold mines to go out there, I think.
One thing that does kind of stand out with a lot of your work is you've done a zombie book as well.
I did, yeah. Yeah, I got asked by Stephen Jones, who put the Zombie Apocalypse books together, to write one of the novels in that series. So it was to be set in Mexico, and I'd been to Mexico only a year or two before, which I think he knew from a short story that I'd written. So yeah, it's basically an absolute zombie riot going through a hotel in Mexico, and it was just so much fun. Yeah.
Was you a fan of zombie stuff beforehand, or?
I'd done short stories mainly for anthologies and on request, really. But when I got asked to do a novel, I thought, you know, there's got to be it's got to be a bit tongue in cheek as well. So it's the one of my books that's got a bit of humour in it, and you know, it's hopefully a bit of a giggle as well.
You have to, when it comes to zombie fiction, you have to be have a bit of comedy in there.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So let's go to your second Bloody Good Read.
My second one is, I read this book quite recently, actually. In fact, I think it was only released in March, but it's The Lamplighters by Emma Stonex that I think a lot of people are talking about, and probably will be for some time, because it's absolutely just exquisite. It's not really a horror novel at all, but it's got a mystery at its heart. So it opens in the 70s with a tower lighthouse out at sea, and the three lighthouse keepers are found to have disappeared, although the doors locked and the clocks in the lighthouse have all stopped at 8:45. And it was inspired by a real case which happened off the Hebrides, although she's relocated it and peopled it with characters of her own. And 20 years later, a writer of maritime adventures comes along, and he starts trying to solve the mystery. So he's interviewing the women who were left behind, and we gradually sort of discover that each character had their own secrets and their own motivations that may have possibly led to them disappearing. And it's just beautifully character driven. But the thing that I adore about this book is just the quality of the writing and the descriptions. I could honestly curl up and die inside this book. It's beautiful. She would never reach for a cliche, you know, that when she's describing the sea, it's as if every spray of brine is just hitting her in the face in the moment, you know. It's gorgeous. And I jotted down a line that's just about one of the lighthouse keepers when he's coming home and eating chips. I mean, it's something as simple as that. And she says, he'd come home smelling of seaweed and sit in his chair eating chips soaked in sarsens from a nest of greasy paper, his hands large and cracked like terracotta pots with halos round the nails. And I just think that's so, it's such a simple thing, but so beautiful. So that's what it's like.
So well.
In this one, it's gorgeous.
That's always a good sign of a good novel, if you can have some kind of simple lines, but written so beautifully. It's just nice. It is nice to get.
Yeah, definitely. And when they have paragraphs that are just so gorgeously written that you have to just read them three times before you move on.
Brilliant choice. It's nice to get some newer titles. You get a lot of Stephen King on this podcast. It's nice to have Stephen King.
Well, I thought about it, because I think we can all pick our favourite Stephen King, and everybody knows them, so it's kind of nice to talk about. But I read a lot of new books as they come out, new writers, so I think it's nice just to give them a plug and say, you know, there's some amazing work coming out all the time, so
amazing new voices at the moment. I have to say, doing this podcast and obviously working alongside with Titan as well, some amazing new voices, brilliant interviews I've done over the last kind of few months with some brand new authors. So it's nice to give a little shout out to kind of talent which is coming out now.
Yeah, definitely.
So
yeah, I mean, there were names actually that you've had on the podcast that I could happily have picked their books as well. T. Kingfisher you had on, I think. The Hollow Place. I couldn't put that one down.
Tim Lemon, you know, has been around for a long, long time, but some of his newer stuff has been amazing. So from there, you got your two newer titles. So I go for the first one, because the brand new book we can go into a bit more detail with. But Mistletoe, A Ghost Story, came out in October 2019.
Yes.
I like the premise of this one. Don't normally get many Christmas-based horror stories. So where did the idea of this one come about?
Well, I think that really grew out of doing the Victorian novels, because... you know, one of the things you think of with genre fiction in the Victorian era is that tradition of sitting around and telling ghost stories on Christmas Eve. And it's something that Dickens popularised by putting them in magazines and things like that. And obviously M.R. James took it on in the early 20th century and did his sort of gatherings where he read a new short story. I mean, wouldn't you just have loved to be a fly on the wall in one of those? So I wanted to set something in that kind of tradition and hark back to the era. So again, it's set in the modern day, but a woman moves into a rundown Yorkshire farmhouse in a dismal corner of Yorkshire, which we love.
And I love it, Yorkshire.
She starts seeing glimpses of the past. So that these ghosts are kind of all around her, but also start to affect her life. And it's almost as if past and present are becoming entwined, as if it was strands of mistletoe, as the title suggests. So it taps into Christmas-related folklore as well, and the folklore around mistletoe, of which is quite a lot. So it brings that strand into it as well, which I really enjoyed.
Obviously, after that, we have your brand new book. So your new book, The Cottonly Cuckoo, has come out. What made you release it under a different name, though? Because you got more of a, it's writing as AJ Elwood now.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, with my previous books, do you know, I'd often wondered whether I should have picked a pen name. I suppose just because I didn't, you know, pick something that sounds cooler than you, really. But when Titan wanted The Cottonly Cuckoo, it was something that they suggested, just in a phone conversation. And I didn't particularly question it, because I just thought, oh, that pen name that I had in mind kind of for the last few years, I could try it and see what happens with that. So I suggested AJ Elwood. Elwood coming from L for my surname and a contraction of Littlewood, but also L is an old term for, you know, it means elf, so it's almost elfwood or fairywood, so it tied into the theme as well. So yeah, I took it from there, really.
Because I've always thought about when I start to publish it again, going under a pseudonym, but I never know whether to do it or not. Yeah, that's why I was a bit intrigued.
Yeah, you can never really have it both ways, can you? So you don't know which would be the best thing to do. But in this case, it's nice to kind of give it a go. And it's oddly liberating. I mean, before, when I've been asked to write bios for myself, you know, you sit there thinking, oh, God, what? Well, I don't know. Who am I? What do I do? But just putting a different name on it, somehow, I wrote it in about 2 minutes. And I thought, blimey, that's the best one I've had so far, really. Even though it's still
me. You can be whoever you want to be. Yeah, because I always thought, you know, do I do a pseudonym with the darker stuff to write? And then, you know, all the stuff that you'd be embarrassed to show your parents, I'll do a pseudonym for. Yeah. But, cool. So
yeah,
where's
it's too late for that minor on to me.
So where did the idea for the new book come about?
Well, originally, I wrote the letters in the book, the ones set in the 1920s, originally as a standalone story. So Ian Waits from Newcom Press, I don't know if you know of them, they're an independent press, he wanted to do a series of horror novellas. So he gave me a nudge and said, do you fancy writing one? And I'd had in mind to play with something around... I was thinking about maybe spirit photography, but then I also started thinking about, old collectors sometimes would have cases with apparent little remains of fairies in them. There's a couple of examples in various museums, I think. And obviously they must be pieced together from other things. But I thought, wouldn't it be lovely to do something around that as well? And I ended up drawing them together in this tale about the Cottingley fairies. Because, I mean, there's lots of things about that hoax that fascinates me as well. I think the fact that there were these little girls who were just fascinated with fairy tales, who were only really making excuses to the parents about why they came in from playing out and their shoes were a bit wet and things. So they said it was the fairies' fault because they were playing in the beck with the fairies. And, you know, they really just took these photographs as a way of proving it to their families. And they could never have imagined the scale of the thing that would grow out of it, or that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle would come along and take an interest. And that's another fascinating strand, that he wrote this rational detective, Sherlock Holmes, and yet at the same time was somebody who could believe in fairies with a very straight face. And, you know, it's easy for us with hindsight to think that's completely crackers. And the interesting thing, I think, about going back in history is you start to see the strands of thought that were around at the time and the stage that people were at, and start to see that he would have seen it as a part of the same logic. You know, he would have seen it as applying scientific method to the supernatural world to try and investigate that as well. And it, obviously his aim was to try and prove that spiritualism was real, but it was all in an investigative sort of sense to him. So there were just lots of strands that fascinated me about it. And it grew out of that, really. Somehow once I'd written those letters, I couldn't kind of get the story out of my head. And I started to think, well, what if somebody in the modern day was reading these one at a time? But strange things started happening in their life as well. And so, you know, what would make somebody now believe in these things as well? Because I'm quite interested in that kind of nature of belief and why people decide to believe the things that they do. So, yeah, it's one of those things that developed over a few years, really.
And I've been getting, you know, a lot of people have been, you know, saying very good things about it so far from what I've read going around. So, no, it's I've got an art copy sitting there in my massive pile of books from Titan, which is the next
one. It's very pretty, isn't it? I'm so happy with the cover.
It's a lovely cover.
Very shiny.
The thing I say every single time on this podcast about Titan, their book design is amazing.
Yeah.
Whoever they pay to do their book covers should be paid a bloody lot of money.
I've been in a couple of their anthologies before, and the first one of those was the Wonderland one, which was stories around Alice in Wonderland. And, oh my goodness, they did an amazing job of that. And yeah, they are superb at covers, I think.
The Alice in Wonderland series, I forgot the author's name now, but there's a grown-up Alice in Wonderland trilogy that they did, and the cover art in that.
Oh, Christine Henry's. Yeah, I love her covers as well. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Fabulous. And brilliant books as well.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant books. But let's segue into your final pick then. So what is your final bloody good read?
My final pick? Oh my goodness, right. This is a tough one, Mark, honestly. I've always rather liked a book that'll make me cry. And I think, again, it's something that dates right back to those early fairy tales. And I can remember loving The Little Mermaid by Hans Christian Andersen, and yet sobbing buckets over it, because, you know, this little fairy tale heroine had done everything she could to win a prince. And she'd done everything right in accordance with, you know, what you'd expect from fairy tales. And yet he didn't love her back, the scumbag. So, you know. I think that was probably one of my first experiences of how powerful stories can be, that could make me cry over these characters and things that don't even exist, you know. But I still love a book that'll make me cry, but this one, oh my God, I sobbed. I mean, it properly ugly cried, you know. It was absolutely devastating. And yet it's a story that is aimed at kids. And it's A Monster Called by Patrick Ness, which he wrote from an idea by Siobhan Dowd, I believe. And it's just heartbreaking. It's about a young boy called Connor who wakes at night and sees a monster that sort of grows out of the yew tree in his garden. And it says it'll tell him three stories, which is very kind of fairy tale-ish in its structure. And then Connor has to tell him a story in return. And if it's not true, the monster will eat him. But meanwhile, Connor's mother's dying of cancer, and the monster's stories are clearly related to his mother's illness and what's going to happen to her. And there's no kind of, it defies sort of easy interpretation as to how they relate to each other, but fantasy and reality start to twine around each other. And it's just, I mean, it's not a book to ever read on the bus, because, you know, if you get to the end, you're going to cry, honestly. Mm-hmm. It's very powerful and very, very moving and beautiful. Mm.
The movie is heartbreaking. I've not read the book, but no, the movie is absolutely heartbreaking.
It is. Yeah, it's a wonderful movie as well, I think. Mm. Yeah.
Watched it at totally the wrong time of life, which I won't go into on this podcast. But it was a hard time, and maybe shouldn't have been watching a film around that subject. It was a lot harder to watch around that time. But
right, yeah, and it's harrowing.
Heartbreaking. Yeah.
Full stop, isn't it? Yeah, I can imagine if. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be really devastating. Yeah.
So one for me, and it's actually in my top three that I had to pick myself, which is the Incident of a Dog in the Night Time. That's a heartbreaking one as well.
Yeah. I read that again quite recently, actually.
Beautiful book, though. Absolutely beautiful book, but so well written. So, what are you working on now? What is your next project?
Oh, my goodness. Well, yeah, I've been working on another Victorian novel, actually, which is based around reports in a book that was published in, I can't remember what year, but it was a Victorian book, and it spoke about this a school where a teacher was said to have a doppelganger. And, you know, the schoolgirl started to report that she'd been seen in two places at once, and it all became bit of a mystery. So I've taken that and wound it into a story where a similar idea, that there's a teacher, I'm not explaining this very well. So it's set in another school a few years further on, where a new teacher is just arriving, and strange events start to happen around this teacher. And again, people think that perhaps there's a ghost of her wandering around, or she's able to project another image of herself that can go in a, like, astral projection or similar ideas. And the girls are sort of harking back to this book that one of them has a copy of, and starting to cast aspersions on her. And yeah, it all becomes a bit of a battle between them. It kind of has the feel of a ghost story, I guess, but there's a little bit more of a mystery going on about what's at the heart of it.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been lovely talking to you and for talking about the books. There's so many of your titles I really want to kind of dig into. As you know, people with this podcast, listening to podcasts, know I'm a slow reader. Haven't read for a long time. Doing this podcast is kind of a way of me to, you know, learn some new titles and get to know some new authors. And, you know, I got so many of your books I want to kind of put onto my shelf at the moment. So really looking forward to that. So where can people find you on social media?
Oh, on social media.
If you want to be found.
I'm on Facebook as Alison Littlewood, and on Twitter as Ali, 2_L, which was one of those mad kind of ideas that I didn't really think through. But I think if you search for Alison Littlewood, or indeed A.H. Elwood, it should come up on there. Cool. Or awesome. Online at alisonlittlewood.co.uk.
Cool. So again, thank you so much to Alison Littlewood for coming on the podcast today. Always, you can find me. No worries. And as always, you can find me over on Twitter at Bloody Good Reads, and on Instagram at Bloody Good Reads. And as always, a huge thank you to our sponsors, Bonneville Book Club. They're an amazing book subscription box service. You get two books recently. So you get a secondhand book, a brand new book, and recently been getting two brand new books recently. So you get that, you get a pin, some hot chocolates, some other drinks in there as well, a nice snack. And that is the full Guts box. If you just want the books, you just get the basic box as well. And you can get your first box for 10% off by using the code Bloody Good Reads. So do go over there. It's a Bonneville Book Club at cratejoy.com. I'll put the link in the description below as well. So go do check them out. And I think if you do it now, you should be ready for next month's box. So go check them out. And as always, thank you for listening to the podcast. I've been your host, Mike Goddard, and I'll see you next time.